Hey there, this is Emily Hoover, and we are so glad that you are listening to the Mission Point Community Church podcast. It's our prayer that this helps you grow in your relationship with Jesus and encourages you to show and share the love of Jesus everywhere you go. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's dive into the message.
This morning, I have the privilege of continuing a series that we've been in for a number of weeks. We are working our way through some of the parables of the New Testament, some of the parables of Jesus. And you've probably heard over the last number of weeks, if you've been with us, that parables are just these stories that Jesus told with a hidden meaning or a message tucked away in them. And you did not know what the meaning of the story was unless heaven revealed it to you or unless Jesus explained it to you. And the theme of the parables that we are looking at, the hidden message and meaning in the particular stories that we are looking at, is really the idea that if you follow Jesus, if you are God's people, then your life is not going to be hidden. The evidence that you follow Jesus should be pretty obvious. Your life should not be a parable. Your life should not be something that requires this major explaining in order to convince somebody that you walk after Jesus. There should be fruit of your faith that shows up in your life. And in the stories we're looking at, in the parables we're looking at, that's actually the message behind them. And this morning, we're going to be looking at one such story in Matthew chapter 21. If you have a copy of the Bible, you can turn there. We're going to start reading that here in a moment. If you don't have a copy of the Bible, the verses will appear on the screen. If you don't own a Bible, we love giving Bibles away. The Word of God, it will change your life. We would love for you to have a written copy of the Bible that you can hold and you can handle. And so if you don't own one, our gift to you, stop by the connection corner, stop by guest services area, and somebody will hand one to you. Matthew chapter 21. In this particular text of scripture, Jesus has actually been telling a series of parables, a series of stories in order to call out the religious elite, the religious Jews who have kind of become self-righteous and super snooty, believing that they are uniquely special to God. So much so that they've actually started to believe that everyone else is just kind of meh, but they are the special ones to God. And they've actually started to make determinations about who belongs and who doesn't, who's in with God and who's out with God. And Jesus is telling these stories to call them out on this. In fact, they don't like Jesus. They're irritated with him because Jesus is spending time with the categories of people that they consider to be on the outs with God. They are irritated because Jesus is actually sharing bits and pieces of his kingdom with those people instead of with us, the super elite, selected, special, chosen by God. And Jesus is telling these stories to call them out. Verse number 33, Matthew 21. Here's the story Jesus tells. It says, listen to another parable. There was a landowner who planted a vineyard, and he put a wall around it, dug a wine press in it, and built a watch tower. So Jesus in this story introduces his hearers to a man who owns some land, and this land is of undisclosed acreage in an undisclosed location. And this man decides to turn this land into a vineyard, which would be a brilliant business move in that cultural context, because there was always going to be a high demand for grapes on account of the fact that there was always going to be a high demand for wine. In the Jewish culture, wine played such a large part in their experiences, from meals to their annual festivals to parties to weddings to snacks. Like, it was always 5 o'clock somewhere. And again, it wasn't done in some drunken type of way. It was just legitimately a part of their cultural experience and expression. Anyway, this landowner strategically does all the work to set up this wine business, this wine venture for success. So he installs a wine press on his property to process the grapes. And the wine press would have just been like a pit dug out in which the harvested grapes would be dumped. And you've probably seen this at some point. And then a bunch of people would take off their shoes and they would start stomping on the grapes to squeeze out the juices, right? And that, the grape juice flavored with like bunions and athlete's foot would pour out of these channels into containers, and it would be collected to be processed for wine. And the owner also wisely builds a wall around his estate to protect it against intruders. He even builds a watchtower, this building that overlooked the entire property and could actually see outside of the wall. So there was no way you could sneak up on this thing. They would see you coming from miles away, which gives us the hint that this wasn't some small enterprise. This wasn't some small piece of property. This was a significant piece of land with a significant business enterprise built on it. Verse number 33, the second part. Then he rented the vineyard to some farmers and moved to another place. When the harvest time approached, he sent his servants to the tenants to collect his fruit. It seems like this business owner, this landowner, had actually successfully managed this piece of property for a while, and then he decides to move, maybe to start a new venture. We don't know. But in either case, he opts to make some passive income by renting his business to some farmers. Now, it's worth noting that the Greek language is a little bit more colorful than the New International Version in this particular context. The word for farmers is really just the word for like servants or hired laborers. The word he uses for rented is a word that could really be translated as hired. And the point is, this man who owned this land and owned this business enterprise, valuable vineyard, he moved. And when he moved, he hired some grape dudes to take care of this piece of property, this wine business, so that when the harvest time came, he would receive a chunk of the proceeds, a chunk of the fruit, and they in turn would get a little portion of it. This was their contractual agreement. It's my land. I'm going to get the majority of it. You're going to get a portion of it. And that's how this is going to work. That is going to be your payment for taking care of my property. Jesus says, when the time for harvest came, this owner sent some of his servants on an errand to go and collect his part of the deal according to the contract. And this is where the otherwise uninteresting story Jesus is telling takes a little bit of a twist. Verse number 35. These tenants, these grape dudes, seized his servants. They beat one, killed another, and stoned a third. This is a true Jesus fashion type of a story that escalates so quickly without warning, and now it's at a PG-13 level of violence. So imagine, these servants could not have received a more straightforward assignment from their boss. This was as easy as it got. Go get my grapes or my barrels of grape juice, whatever it was. Go get my stuff from my hired grape dudes and then come back. Any questions? No, can't think of anything we've done this simple in a very long time. No one in this story, and definitely none of the servants who are on this particular errand would have suspected what would come next. Hired grape dudes beat one servant, they stone another servant, and they kill the third. Oof. Which raises, by the way, so many questions, but the main question is, why? Why? I mean, I understand it's very clear that they're not particularly interested in giving up any of this harvest. We get that. Somehow, they are just going to hang on to it. Fine. But why not just send a nice note of rejection of terms and send these dudes back to their kids in one peace. Now, the story almost seems to suggest that they were so enraged by the servant's request for them to do the thing they contractually agreed to, they were furious that they attacked them. Now, I don't know your suspicion, I don't know how your mind works, but to me, it's almost like, I don't know, something happened with these guys. During the months while the grapes were growing, the boss maybe has no reason to text them. He has no reason to show up to chit-chat. He has no reason to call them. He has no reason to check in on them. And I wonder if in this season of silence, as the grapes grew and the master was doing his own thing, if they started to think, maybe he forgot about this place. Rich dude like that, he has so many properties. Maybe he just forgot about this. Matter of fact, I wonder if he actually meant that he was giving it to us to completely own. And then, yeah, I wondered that as well, because we haven't heard anything from him, and surely he would have at least sent a like save the harvest date card to us, but we've heard nothing from him. We might be in the clear. I think we may be in the clear. So, dude, I'm just wondering, so what are you going to do with all of the money from the profits that we make? I don't know, man. I've already put a down payment on a house, and I'm just waking. What about you? Like, I'm Chick-fil-A franchise. Like, I'm all in. I've already started thinking how I'm going to spend my money. Whatever the reason is, by the time the servants show up to collect, the workers are treating this property like it belongs to them by right. So they kill a guy, they assault another with rocks, and they beat a third. Can you imagine what the owner does when he hears this? Nope, you actually cannot imagine. Because look at what he does. He does not do what I would have expected him to do. He doesn't call authorities. He doesn't press charges. It says in verse 36, then he, the landowner, sent other servants to them, more than the first time. And these grape dudes, the tenants, treated them the exact same way. The landowner, he sends more servants to go and collect what rightfully belonged to him. Not to enforce, not to escalate the situation, not to intensify things. He doesn't send new servants with weapons who are specially trained on grape retrieval. He just sends more servants to say, please, would you do what you agreed to do and give me what belongs to me? I just don't think this is how I would have handled this situation. Matter of fact, this response seems bad for business. This is not how you become an intimidating mob boss in that particular world. This may be the thing that has people mistaking you for soft, a pushover, a bit of a doormat. And that's exactly what the great boys think of him. And so they give the same business to these servants as well. They escalate to a PG-13 level of violence, beat down, concussion protocol, and they kill some of them. Ooh, when the word gets back to the boss, he is so unusual in his response. Check this out. Verse number 37. Last of all, he sent his son to them. They will respect my son, he said. And I'm like, what? I'm just saying, this boss man is built different. He continues to give these brutes like the benefit of the doubt. Like, let's try this again. Maybe they didn't believe that these servants represented me. I don't know. Maybe they didn't respect the servants because they are on the same level on the totem pole as the people I sent to them. I know. They may not believe, they may not respect, they may not respond to my servants, but they would definitely believe and respect and respond to my son. So he sends his son. My son that looks like me, my own flesh and blood, my heir. Sending my son. It's pretty much as though I were going myself. Surely they'll respond to my son. Verse number 38. But when the tenants saw the son, they said to each other, "This is the heir. Come, let's kill him and let's take his inheritance." So they took him and threw him out of the vineyard. And they killed him. Wow. So here in this moment, the story Jesus is telling, this parable reaches its emotional climax. And there isn't a person listening to this story who isn't feeling emotionally intense. There is no way not to. Any question about the mindset or the motives of these gardeners is completely removed, and Jesus makes it very clear. No, they see the boss's son, they know exactly who he is, and they immediately devise a plan to permanently take him out. And their logic is solid. He's the heir. He's the heir. He stands to inherit this property that we are now living on. The only thing standing between us and immense wealth is this dude right here. If we take him out, it belongs to us. If he's out, we're in. And that's exactly what they do. Take him outside the walls of the vineyard and they execute him in cold blood. I'm guessing at this point you can hear a pin drop as Jesus is telling this story. It's emotional. And it begs an emotional response. Man, I can still remember my sophomore year at Grace. I was between classes and I went to check my email in the computer lab, because that's how we did it on the campus in Philadelphia. There was a computer lab. And so I went and checked I don't know if you can call it email, and dial up. I went and did all of it. I had one solitary email waiting for me from some dude that I knew, but we weren't like on emailing level, so I wasn't sure why he was emailing me. But the email was very, very simple in its content. It simply said, "Dear Condo, I'm sorry to inform you that your grandparents have died." And that was it. Now, quick PSA. Don't do that. Don't do that. That's not cool. Especially for somebody who's 14,000 miles away from home. Like, don't do that. I can still remember, I think the first call I made was to my brother, and it was my brother who filled in the details. My grandparents were incredible, generous people. And they had retired, and in their retirement, they had bought a piece of property, a farm outside the capital city of Zambia, with every intent to live out their days with the elbow room of hobby farm life. One day, apparently, a stranger knocked on their door who was completely down and out. And he expressed to them that he was hungry and he was homeless and he was looking for something to eat. And so my grandparents, in their generosity, they took him in. They gave him food, they gave him a place to stay. And the agreement was that he would help with chores around the farm. One day, my grandfather was out in the garden, and who understands such things? This dude grabbed a farm tool and executed him in cold blood. Went into the house, found my grandmother in her bedroom, executed her in cold blood. And then he actually took over the house. He made a meal and he sat there and he ate and he just hung there for a while like it was his place. I don't care who you are, you probably have feelings about that. You probably have an emotional response to that story. And the emotional responses may vary. For some of you, you may be like, is he just telling this story to get a rise out of us? For some of you, you're going to be like, if that is true, is he okay? And some of you are like, forget if he's okay. Are we okay? Like, how can he get up there and tell a story like that that disrupts our day emotionally? Because it's about us, right? Like, you're going to have an emotional response. So you're going to have an emotional response. I said, whatever happened to this dude? So a couple of things. First of all, that is a very true story. That's how my grandparents died. Very true story. But you are missing the point. The point is the question Jesus asks this crew. And the question is, what do y'all think should happen to that guy? That's the question. What do you think should happen to a dude who did something like that? Which is exactly the question Jesus asks these people at the end of this story. He tells this incredibly emotional story about the execution of the owner's son by these entitled brats and brutes who had begun to believe that this was their piece of property. And Jesus asks, I'm just asking y'all, how do you think the owner should respond to a person who does something like that? And there is nobody who is emotionally disconnected without a feeling about this. In fact, here's the question. Verse 40, Jesus says, therefore, when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those tenants? Those hired hands who've decided the boss's property and enterprise now belongs to them. Privilege of working for him wasn't enough. We are going to own his stuff so much that they disregarded every message he sent and every servant he sent and finally executed his son. So now the boss is coming in person. And the question is, what do you think he's fixing to do to the grape gang? That's the question. The religious leaders who Jesus is talking to, they answer right away because Jesus has brilliantly invited them into the emotion of the story. That is Jesus. He's such a brilliant storyteller. He will have you agreeing with him before you even realize what happened. And they answer right away. He will end them when he comes, they say passionately. Grapes of wrath, no doubt. Woo! Look at what they say, verse 41. He will bring those wretches to a wretched end. Listen to the language they're using. They replied, and he will rent the vineyard to other tenants who will give him his share of the crop at harvest time. He will eliminate the grape gang, and he will find someone else who will actually give him what is his. And then Jesus drops the mic, verse 42. Jesus said to them, have you never read the scriptures? The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. Woo, now he's talking about himself. The Lord has done this, and it is marvelous in our eyes. Therefore, I tell you that the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a people who will actually produce its fruit. Anyone who falls on this stone will be broken to pieces. Anyone on whom it falls will be crushed. When the chief priests and the Pharisees heard Jesus' parables, they knew, oh, he's talking about us. He's talking about us. God is going to take the privilege of his kingdom affairs and give them to people who will actually do what he wants. Unlike y'all. You are acting snooty and special. You know what God has asked, but you're not actually doing what he has said. Oh, and he's going to put you in the wine press and crush you. Parables. Jesus is telling a story about God's relationship with the Jews, and in particular, these Jewish religious leaders who have a problem with Jesus hanging out with the spiritual outsiders. And he does it by essentially reminding them of their own spiritual history. He's talking about his Father in heaven. This is his parable. There was once a God who created the whole world. And within that world, he chose a special people for himself, the Jews. And he encircled them with his love. And he protected them as though sitting in a watchtower, if you will, calling them to draw near to him in relationship and calling them to represent him in the world around them. I sent Moses, and Moses delivered my law to you. If you are going to step into relationship with me and represent me in the world around me, here are the rules and here are the regulations. And I sent Moses to give the laws to you, and all of you understood exactly what the terms of the contract were. But over time, I don't know if it was because I got too silent, y'all started to act entitled like the manna was yours. Something happened in your hearts and your hearts started to become hardened and you started to believe that you had every right to every single thing that had invited you into. Y'all turned on Moses, you turned on my word, and you did your own thing. So what did I do? Well, I sent the prophets. And the prophets came carrying fresh doses of my personal messages to you, because that's what relationship is, me talking to you and you talking to me. And they delivered what I told them to tell you, me speaking to you. And they put on demonstrations and displays of my great power to remind you who it was that was calling you and to remind you what it was I was calling you to represent in the world around you. And what did y'all do with the prophets? You mistreated them, you disregarded what they said, and you even put some of them to death. Think about how you treated John the Baptist, my prophet, not too long ago. And so, what did I do? How does Hebrews 1 put it? Look at it, verse 1. In the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, and through whom also he made the universe. Verse 3, the Son, Jesus, is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. And so what did I finally do? I finally sent my Son, my exact representation, to my representatives. Surely my people will listen to him, because sending my Son who looks just like me is like coming down myself. Maybe they thought, Moses, who do you think you are? You're not better than us. We're equals. Maybe they thought of the prophets, well, you guys are just ordinary people. Like, why should we listen to you? You're not that special. But if I send my Son, my heir, my exact representation, they will surely listen to him. Jesus is now speaking prophetically about himself. And you religious leaders, what you don't know now is I am the stone. I am the heir that you will ultimately reject. I am God in the flesh, and I will be such a threat to your entitled rebellion and your special snooty way of life that you would do with me exactly what you did with the law, exactly what you did with the prophets. You would disregard me, and ultimately, you would take me outside the city gates and you will execute me in cold blood. I'm talking about you. I'm talking about y'all. But the son y'all rejected, he's going to be the heir anyway. And what do you think God will do with y'all then? He will take you out of play and offer the call of this relationship and this representation to the very people that you believe don't belong. And by the way, if you're a non-Jew sitting in this room, that should be your cue to shout. That's how you got in. That's exactly what God did. He said, oh, y'all don't want it? I'm going to open the door. People from every tribe and every background and every nation, and they're going to become heirs to the same promises, heirs to the same grace. They will be grafted in on account of your rejection of Jesus Christ. The religious leaders, he's talking about us. How dare he? Doesn't he know who we are? We would never do such a violent thing. How dare he? And they started to plot his death. It's so ironic. Verse 46, they looked for a way to arrest him. But they were afraid of the crowd because the people held that he was a prophet, the very thing Jesus was predicting. You've mistreated the calling to know your God and to make him known. And you know the terms of the contract, but you're not doing it. The very people you were called to represent God to are the people you were just shoving out and saying, you all don't belong. So, he's taking his invitation elsewhere. To people who would not just know what he says, but actually do something with it. Okay. What about us? What message might be hidden in this parable on this Palm Sunday for those of us sitting in the room? A couple of things. Number one, I think this story is an incredible reminder that you just work here. You just work here. It doesn't matter what we're talking about, you just work here. What am I saying? I'm saying, in this world, you own nothing. There is only one great landowner. There's only one great wine press installer. There's only one great watchtower builder, and he is the God of the universe. There is only one great creator. There's only one great owner of the world, one ruler of every realm, and he is our God. I love the way David says this in 1 Chronicles 29. He says, yours, Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the majesty and the splendor, for everything in heaven and earth is yours. Yours, Lord, is the kingdom. You are exalted as head over all. Wealth and honor come from you. You are the ruler of all things. In your hands are strength and power to exalt and give strength to all. Woo. This is a great reminder for us that we ought to live with the declaration. In fact, we'll put it up on the screen so you can say it and absorb it. I own nothing. It doesn't matter what we're talking about. God owns it. It's his. I own nothing. I just work here. I'm just a hired hand who God has invited to make a profit for his name's sake. And one day he's going to ask me, so what did you do? Give me my fruit. Give me what belongs to me. Well, but he hasn't asked me about it for so long. I've started to believe that maybe it's mine. Nope. It's all his. In this world, I own Nothing. I'm just gardening for him. I'm just stomping grapes. I'm a parent. I manage five kids, not very well most of the time. Technically, they are not my children. They're God. He has allowed me for a season of time to manage them. That privileged responsibility. And there's a time he is going to return and he will have questions about how I managed his humans. The moment I forget that, oh boy, I start to helicopter as a parent. I start to become super clingy, like you may not leave this radius and your family's gonna have to live this long and you're gonna have to be home for Thanksgiving because you know, this is what, and before long, if I'm not careful, I start to try and make them what I was not. I start to make decisions about whether they're in or out with God based on how they respond to my rules. Preach, Kondo. I own nothing. We just work here, y'all. You don't own this country. I'm sorry to break it to you in an election year. You just live and work here to make much of the kingdom of God. If you forget that, you are going to become super snooty and special, making decisions about who deserves this piece of real estate and this land a little bit more than this. And you're going to start, and before long, you will surprise yourself how violent you got against certain people on social media, concussion protocol, PG-13. Like, how did we become so mean to each other? Because I believed that is now mine, and they are, and I'm here, and look at what happens to us. It's not yours. It's not your money. It's not your house, which is one of the reasons you don't get to take it with you. You just manage it. You just work for God with it. And when it's all said and done, he's going to ask you, how did you steward my house? And how did you steward my money? And how did you steward my, how did you do? The minute I stop believing that, I will cling on to it, boy. And anyone who tries to say anything about it, it's not your breath. And I just would suggest, don't test God on that one. His breath in your lungs so you can breathe out his praise and so you can use it to make much of his name so that you can call out in relationship and that you can cry out in representing him in the world around you. It's not your body. Those are not your gifts. And I'm just asking, are you living like you own it or are you living like he does? God, it's all yours. Help me to honor you with it. You just work here. That perspective will revolutionize your peace, your generosity, the way you live. Second observation, stop killing Jesus. Yeah, that's intense, I know. One of the ways we know we are the religious community that Jesus is addressing is that we will hear stories like this and we will distance ourselves from the villains in the story and we'll always identify with whoever we view as the good guys. So we read a story like this, and if we place ourselves in this story, we're like, yes, I'm the servant who got sent on an errand, and I came back beaten and bruised. You know, like, that's where we'll place ourselves. And those are the religious, violent brutes who took over the vineyard. We're the grape gang, y'all. Jesus is talking to us. And one of the most beautiful ways to step into these stories is to get a sense of what are the things that Jesus might be saying to me. My tendency is, no, what's he saying to them, those people? No, what's he saying to me. Because I'll read a story like this and I will immediately distance myself because I would never be the person who violently assaults or attacks somebody, let alone kills somebody. That is not me. And if Jesus is saying this, is ultimately speaking to the religious leaders who would execute him, that is definitely not me. And I'm like, it's us. Stop killing Jesus. God sends his word reminding us that we are living in his body. It's not your body, it's his body, and he bought it at a price, and he calls you to honor him with his body that you just happen to live in for a season. How do you respond to that? Are you honoring him with your body? What you do with it sexually? What you put in it substantially? Or do you agree with the message in public? Like, I understand what he said in his word, but I'm going to disregard it in private. When he comes, is there a harvest of purity in your life with your body? Or is the story more like, he hasn't said much about it to me. I mean, is the story more like, it's my life? Is the story more like, it's my body? Is the story more like, I was born this way? Is the story more like, but I can do with it whatever I want? And if somebody tells me what I'm going to do with my body, woo-wee, don't you dare. I'm just asking, how are you interacting in reality? Because if at the end of the day, like, listen, it's my body and it's my passions, it's my stuff, and I start to act like I own the things. I can spend on what I want to spend on, and no one can tell me what to spend on, and I don't have to be generous, even if God has said to be generous. I'm going to do my own thing. This story is about us. Because did you know that if you're a believer, you're a believer because you believe Jesus died for your sin? You believe every sin you commit is a sin Jesus had to die for. That Jesus was dragged outside the city gates to die for your sin. And I'm just asking, does knowing that your sin killed Jesus make you willing to sin less? Or, I love porn and it's my body, and if Jesus has to die, Jesus has to die. I'm just asking you, if you know deliberately sinning is what put Jesus on the cross, does that make you less willing to sin? And if you're intentionally just continuing in your sin, I'm just saying to you, this story is about us. Stop killing Jesus. I would never hurt Jesus, no? But you know the price for what you're doing. I know it. And you're doing it anyway. I'm doing it anyway. This is about you. I would never do what happened to Kondo's grandparents. I'd never do what this story did. I'd never do what this did to Jesus. And the question is, do I deliberately continue to persist in the very things I know sent him to the cross? Is there a way you need to own that you are the tenant in the story? God, forgive me for mistreating your son by my deliberate sin. If I don't identify with that part of the story, I miss out on the best part. And this is the last observation. Praise God for his grace. One of the coolest parts of this story is that it ends in the future tense. I love that. Jesus is asking, what do you think the owner will do when he ultimately comes back? What do you think he'll do? That is such a beautiful question. Do you know why it's a beautiful question? Because it means he's not back yet. He's not back yet. Religious leaders, I've not gone to the cross yet. There is still time. If you are breathing air, and if you are listening to this servant carrying this message. It's grace upon grace upon grace. God is saying there's still time. There's still time in this silent season of grace. Still time to respond to this glorious invitation of Jesus to run to him in relationship and to represent him in the world around. There's still time to acknowledge that I have treated your privileges like they are my rights. I've treated what you've lent to me as though I own it. And there's still time to say, may my story be different. That's grace. That there's still time. And this Palm Sunday, we start to celebrate Jesus heading towards the cross to pay for every sin. And that's the beauty of the gospel. And he came and he called us to his rules and to his way. And we just ran and we rebelled and we refused to do it. And so what did he do? He sent word and then we refused and we rebelled. And what did he do? He sent his son and we refused. And what did he do? He sent reminders of his son. And then what did we do? He sent blood to cover our sin. And then what did he do? Well, grace abounded where sin abounded. And he just continues to send grace while there's incredible time. Not because he's soft. Don't mistake his patience for him being a pushover. Don't mistake his grace for you getting away with it. It is exactly that. It's grace. God saying, there's still time. I don't know how much there is. Don't know when it'll end. But in the meantime, there's incredible grace for each and every one of us to say, I want to be part of your kingdom enterprise, and I want to live as though everything is yours, and I want to return your proceeds to you and your profits to you, and I want to live in relationship with you and represent you in the world around. And there's still time. I wonder what for you, you would say the Spirit might be calling you to. To do areas that you've claimed and locked down as yours. Maybe it's places where you are deliberately sinning and you know it. And the Spirit is saying, stop it. Or places where you believe like, I'm gone, too far gone, I'm done. And Jesus is saying, there's still time, there's grace. Come and drink deep. And even as we share in communion, what an amazing reminder. Jesus went to the cross. He went into the wine press. And he was crushed for our sin. And his blood poured out. And through his blood, we get to experience being heirs with him in the very things that we've tried to take over. They're going to be ours anyway by the grace of God in the person of Jesus. Father, thank you so much for your immense kindness to us. And even now as we share in communion, I pray that we would be reminded of your incredible grace that covers our sin, that we would be reminded of the cost of our rebellion, that we would be reminded of the invitation to be co-heirs, that we would be reminded of the message that you've sent to us and that we get to carry to the world, that we would be reminded of the relationship we get to live in with you. So Lord, even now as we sing, I just, may we raise our voices with gratitude for the grace that you have poured out on us in Jesus Christ. And it's in his name we pray. Amen.
Thanks so much for tuning into today's message. We hope to see you next Sunday. We would love to personally invite you to one of our services at 9 and 10:45 a.m. in the Performing Arts Center in Warsaw Community High School at One Tiger Lane in Warsaw, Indiana. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please make sure to subscribe, review, and connect with us on social media by following Mission Point CC. You can also contribute to what God is doing through Mission Point. Simply visit missionpoint.net/give and give a gift today. Thanks again for joining us. Have a great week.